every bigger game, or at least every game that's similar to ours, open world RPG, you have all these dialogues that you can go into, and there's a huge complex quest logic that goes into it, and you have someone like technical designer or scripter, or multiple people usually on one quest that are making this happen, that they are doing and telling the NPCs what to do, how to behave, where to go, and so on. All this information is basically stored in this system that we have. We call this application Scald. And as you mentioned, it's a standalone tool because we had so many users for it. It was not only technical designers and gameplay designers and people who actually wrote the dialogues, but it was also like sound designers and sound directors when you were recording voiceovers.
Welcome to In Development, the podcast about the real technical challenges and trade-offs behind building complex games and digital worlds. I'm your host, Jace Lindgren, and today I'm joined by Peter Noël, a developer at Warhorse Studios, to talk about Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 and what it actually takes to ship an open-world RPG with hundreds of hours of content without it collapsing under its own complexity. We dig into Scout, Warhorse's in-house tool for managing quests, branching dialogue, world logic, and why they kept it separate from the main game engine, and how they automated validation and testing to prevent a single broken connection from blocking progression for everyone on the team. Peter also walks through how small teams build tools that scale to hundreds of contributors. And then we have a little bit of fun looking at how some memes from Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 ended up in the second one as an intentional design. If you care about narrative systems, internal tools, scaling complexity without losing control, there is a lot to learn here. So I'm really excited to get into this conversation with Peter. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So, we're here to talk about Warhorse and Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 and some of what went on there. And so, first, I kind of wanted to set the scene. So, first, I have an interesting story is that I kind of came across the game by accident. I did not play Kingdom Come Deliverance 1, but recently my wife was playing Ghost of Yote, and I was like, you know, I want to play an open world kind of game too. What's out right now? What's going on? And I saw Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. It was getting good reviews. So I was like, all right, I'll check that out. And I got totally hooked on it. Played it a ton, played it all the way through, which is not something I normally do. I play a lot of games because I want to see what's out there. I want to see what people are doing, but I rarely play a game all the way to the end. But I did with Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, even though it's super long, because of how much depth and detail and nuance there was throughout that, which is really exciting to me whenever a game studio can do that. So can you tell me a little bit about the history that led up to this? One, like how long were you working on Kingdom Come Deliverance 2? And then also kind of what's the story of Kingdom Come Deliverance into the sequel?
Sure. So I basically joined the studio when we were transferring from Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 and 2.
Okay.
So I joined on the DLCs basically after the release of the first game. And so basically I worked on KCD 2 for like the whole development when it started. And the first game actually came out and it had like few tiny little issues and bugs here and there. So we were actually like fixing the game for quite some time. After the release, I think that like the last patch, which actually still included major changes in code, was released like a year after the game was actually like in the whole state and actually playable without, let's say, major bugs that would
right,
be there.
Right.
And yeah, about the game itself, we are super, super happy that people are actually playing it from the beginning till the end, because definitely not the case for most games. You know, some people just like buy it and have it inside their Steam library or
right,
wherever, and they just say, okay, one day I maybe play it.
Yeah, I've got a lot of those. Yeah.
Yeah, but from the data we have, we actually see that people actually enjoy the game a lot, and they're spending a lot of time inside it. And it's not just only tens of hours, but maybe hundreds, some people even thousands of hours
wow,
inside the game.
Yeah.
So that's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, that's great. And I think you hit on something interesting with talking about the first game coming out and how there were, you know, some issues with that. I feel like at this point, that's become kind of, as an audience, what we expect from any kind of big open world game. It's almost like there's this expectation there's going to be weird stuff that breaks, especially when it's first released. And, you know, we've seen this with everything from the Elder Scrolls games like Skyrim to, you know, Cyberpunk or this. And it's so interesting to me that that plagues the entire genre because of just how many moving parts there are, how many pieces there are, that there's so much content. It's basically impossible for any human to have actually explored the whole state space and test it all.
Yeah, that's very much true. But also, not only designers, but everyone in the company thinks that the game should be like super immersive. And basically every bug you introduce, it breaks that immersion. So It was, for our technical departments, it was crucial thing to have everything running smoothly, ideally bug-free, no like showstoppers that you would, I don't know, enter a dialogue or something and then be stuck in the game and need to restart it if you're like in the middle of the conversation with some NPC that's really important in the story and so on. So, as you said, there are many titles that struggled with it, and the KCD one definitely struggled with it as well. But I think that overall we did a good job for the sequel, and I don't think that it came back free, but it was much, much better than the first game, and we all were super happy about the outcome, I think, from the technical perspective. Not only the technical perspective, but I see it mostly from technical perspective. So
right.
When I saw like Digital Foundry videos, when they said, okay, this is running smoothly on console, 60 FPS, no hitches, this is the industry standard that it should be, I was like super happy. And also other guys from programming department, they were super, super happy when this video came out, and even other like references and fans that were posting that the game is actually running well. Of course, always there are some bugs, but we tried to tackle them throughout this last year. That we did a lot of patches, but most of them were just like a new content, not really like bug fixes.
Yeah, I haven't played any of the DLC yet, just played through the main story so far. But I will say that, yeah, I can only think of maybe one kind of weird issue, but it was like I got stuck on geometry somewhere. It wasn't even really like a real game-breaking bug so much, and I was able to get out of it. But I've been really impressed with how big the world is and how many things are going on, but also that it has been quite stable. And so can you tell me, how long did it take to develop KCD1, and then how long for KCD2? How did those compare?
Warhorse was founded 2011, and it was released 2018, so that's 7 years.
Okay.
And then you had KCD2, which you would say, okay, the development started right after KCD1, which was not really true. Partially, some people worked on it, but mainly most of the people were still concentrating on DLCs and bug fixing.
Right.
And like the whole programming department was just still on the bug fixes for at least a year. So you had like this 1+ year period on the first game. So maybe summer 2019, it was the time when actually like the whole company started development on KCD2. KCD2 was released last year, 2025. So it's been like 6 years versus 7 to 8 years. So pretty much like similar timeline.
Right. And what was the size of the team for KCD2, for most of that at least?
It varied a lot. When I joined the company, there was around 100 people. I think right now we are almost 300, and it grew over time. So I cannot say, because it was just like rising and rising. Every day I met someone new in the office, and I was trying to find out from which department he is. And if it's not an imposter, that's just like trying to get in our studio.
Yeah.
To get a free tour or something. But yeah, it was at the end, it was all like 250 when we, like a year ago, when we were finishing the project, I think.
Okay, got it. So quite a large team. And quite a lot of that was also in-house then, right? Like a lot of the art and design. How much was this having to get, you know, co-development studios or contracting, versus how much do you tend to do all of this in-house?
I cannot speak for like all the individual departments, but mostly we were doing everything in-house. There were some exceptions, of course. One is localization.
Right.
Which I think every studio or most of the studios, if it's a huge game, then you don't just have the capacity and the experts on the language. So
right.
It doesn't make sense to do it in-house. But mostly, other than that, there are some animations. But other than that, I think it was... You can see in the credits at the end of the game that there were some studios that were helping us. For example, in code, we had All Cat Games, which were few programmers that were helping us with the CryEngine. But mostly it was all in-house.
Nice. Yeah. And so before we get into the main topic, which is going to be about how you managed to have such a complex system of quests and dialogue and things like that, I had a few questions about just the process of managing as many assets as there were in the game and kind of the scope of the world. Because something that I found I kept pausing at certain points in the game to just go and like look at a stained glass window or to look at, you know, a brocade pattern on some fabric that was draped over a chair or something like that. And as I would get closer to them, I would see like these are really high-res textures, right? There's a lot of details here in just every little thing in the world. Or one particular moment I remember was I was exploring this house, and this is, my wife was in the room at the same time, and she was like, huh, what is that in the corner there? I was like, yeah, you're right. It's just kind of a pillar here, or like a block out of the corner. Is there a hidden thing in here? What is it? And she's like, oh, maybe there's a chimney that runs through there. And I was like, oh, let me check. And so I ran downstairs to the next floor. I'm like, no, it's still here. And then I went down one more. I was like, oh, yep, there's a fireplace here. Like that everything kind of had this internal consistency to it. And I just thought about what an undertaking that is to coordinate so many people working on something, but to have kind of this internal consistency in the world. Like you said, you don't want to break that illusion. You don't want to break that immersion. What is that process like when you're dealing with those big of teams? You know, how are you keeping this all coordinated and organized and having everyone work on those same assets and same levels and stuff?
Well, that's a hard one for sure, you know, because as you say, like many people are, they just try to contribute and they are doing their profession. And you as a programmer are telling them all the time, you cannot do this. And they are frustrated because they have to obey all these rules. But if they didn't, it would be such a mess, you know, it would then look like a student project when you have like this new file and you call it final and then you call it final final and then you call it master final version 2 and so on. So this is something that we always need to take account that people are going to change things and we need to think in advance what it's going to look like in 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, because as I mentioned, we worked on the same project for 7 years. That's quite a long time. Like many babies were actually born when we were like developing the game. I remember our head of development, Martin Klima, he was like at one meeting and he said, okay, we are releasing the game. And just like, if you think about it, like when we started, the babies were born and now they are actually in the first grade. You know? They are going to school now. So this was kind of interesting to hear, you know, and if you think about it, it's quite... For all of us, it's been a huge project and it's like not a small portion of your life. You know, if you're like attending some university, you're probably there for a shorter amount of time than we did on just one project. So, but I don't want to like run away from the question. It was a challenge, of course, but the things that are being placed in the level, like in the open world per se, the designers and artists, they try to make it look that everything's there, visible, and they can show all the different things that are happening and all the houses are different and like there are these tiny little details and so on. But honestly, it's not that many assets in the open world. The complexity goes into the quests because some designer comes and there's like one scenario that's only been done in the game once. So you need to create all these assets just for that one quest that you play for like 30 minutes.
Right.
But then everything else you can pretty much reuse, you know, so you have apples and you have apples inside every village.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
You have benches and every you name it. They are all the same assets, but you see the tiny little differences. Is an environment level artist they can do, but it's reusable.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good point that the assets that you have in the game have a lot of care put into them. Like I said, the textures are really detailed, but it's not that everything is unique in every area, but that your level designers were very intentional about placing things in ways that feel realistic, that feel meaningful.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's a great point for how to keep that sustainable, is kind of keep a limited number of things, but then you can try to be creative in how you place those and how you use those. That makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. But there's like problems from the actual graphical assets into problems with Windows. You cannot name a file that has more than 260 characters right. inside it, because then everything breaks.
Yep.
And people are like, okay, it's year 2020. What the hell are you telling me? I cannot have like this long name. And, you know, they cannot understand some of these things. So you need to explain. And then you are on those meetings that where people are just angry that they cannot work because there is some validation and so on. So sometimes it's a little bit stressful to just like explain it all over again, but that comes with the process.
Yeah, I feel like that's a theme that has been recurring in a lot of these podcast interviews, is that push and pull between creativity and then either needing to keep things organized or keep them performant or, you know, something like that, like the validation versus creativity. And I think that's a valuable push and pull, right? Like both teams need to be able to pull on each other to try to get the right result at the end.
Yeah, definitely. They try to multiple times, they come to you with one problem and then you're telling them no for, I don't know, like fifth time, and then sixth time you're like, okay, well, let's do something about it. So you just don't come to me again. So yeah, this happens quite a lot as well.
So yeah, finally you have to make it possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. So you teased the quests earlier and how that's kind of a unique area where animations, some of the assets, and then also, you know, the dialogue obviously is going to be unique for all of those. And for this, you developed a tool in-house that's separate from the game engine itself. Tell us a little bit about that. What is that?
Okay, so I think like every bigger game, or at least every game that's similar to ours, open world RPG, you have all these dialogues that you can go into, and there's a huge complex quest logic that goes into it, and you have someone like technical designer or scripter, or multiple people usually on one quest that are making this happen, that they are doing and telling the NPCs what to do, how to behave, where to go, and so on. And all this information is basically stored in this system that we have. We call this application Scald. And as you mentioned, it's a standalone tool. Usually some studios integrate it into the engines. For example, it's very similar to Unreal Engine's blueprints that these days are very popular. So, but we were on CryEngine, and this was not something that we could use.
Right. But by making this tool exist outside of the engine, did that mean that people who don't work in the engine could also use it? That it kind of made it more accessible?
Yes, definitely. Because we had so many users for it. It was not only technical designers and gameplay designers and people who actually wrote the dialogues, but it was also like sound designers and sound directors when you were recording voiceovers and localization. Mm. So it was also usable for cutscenes, that you could actually see the script for the cutscenes as well. And for the localization studios, as I mentioned, we could distribute it outside to our like external partners. This was standalone, so we could like easily tell them, okay, here you have the application, you know how to set it up, and you don't need our engine and some custom pipelines. It's just all in bundled inside this standalone application.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating to me, that something that maybe started as a limitation became a feature like that, that then you're able to ship this around separately.
Yeah, it was basically like a feature from the beginning, or it basically started only as a tool for designers. It was only for the dialogues at the beginning, and the quest logic was basically written inside Lua script, which is not visual, or it was inside the engine itself. And then after KCD1 was created, we decided, okay, we want to extend this tool. And actually right now it can do so many different things, as I mentioned. So
got it. So was this used on KCD1, or it started with KCD2?
Like partially as I said, it was used for the dialogues, but not for much else. So it's like completely different application. If you would compare these two, you would probably, well, you would recognize it, but it has like completely different functionality right now.
Yeah, so that's what I want us to get into today, is kind of looking at this tool, not just at how it works, but also why it was important. And so you developed this tool with a team of, how big is that team relative to the whole team?
It's kind of hard to say because you have programmers that are working on the tool, like in C#, so they do all the features, but then you have the other programmers that are working on the game, and they need to cooperate because they say, okay, in the game you want to add this functionality, and this functionality needs to go into the Scald application. So there was a team of a few programmers, and basically full-time on the C# part itself, there were two people, and then on the C++ side, it depended on what features we needed to add. So sometimes it was two people, sometimes four, sometimes one. It like really varied throughout the development, but there was like one person only responsible for the concept graph, which is basically all the quest logic inside the C++, inside the engine. And he was basically working on this Scald tool, but inside the engine. So
I see, like the hooks for how it could talk to and get information from the engine.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So at least three people all the time, but sometimes more.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So let's talk about, like, how does the tool work? I think we've got a little bit of a sense where was originally for dialogue, but now you said it's been expanded to do more than that.
Yeah.
So that includes things like triggering certain animations or like pathing for NPCs. Those sorts of things? Am I getting the right idea?
Yeah, I didn't mention one thing, and that's the NPC logic, like all the what we call AI systems. Mm-hmm. They are mostly in C++, or they are in the trees inside the engine. So all the NPC logic, like navigation on the navmesh and so on, this is not part of this tool. This is only, as I mentioned, for dialogues and for the quest logic. So it collaborates with the game, and sometimes it like sends the signals in between, like back and forth, but it's not like 100% of the logic, but like very, very big part of it. So it's not a straight line. It's usually depends on the scriptor, like how much of it he wants to do inside Scald, how much of it he wants to do in some other tool. And it's based on like individual features and quests. So it's really hard to tell.
Got it. But so in Scald is where you would say, now this character is going to go over here, but then the engine logic takes care of the pathing of how they get there.
Yeah, if we oversimplify it, let's say it could be like that, but it's more like a state-based or trigger-based. If there's some logic triggered from, like, there is a signal inside C++ that say, okay, player entered this area, then some logic happens. Like, some things are streamed in. For example, you enter some area, so you need to stream in, like, a grave or something. That's something's going to happen with that grave. So all the scriptor does is he needs to like basically prepare the parts of the levels and prepare everything so the quest is ready, the NPCs are ready, and yeah, so it's as you say, like, yeah.
Got it. So yeah, talk to us a little bit about, you know, what's the process like of working with this tool, and how did this make this scale of world possible?
Okay, well, as I mentioned, there's like many, many users. So if I take it from like what the position we call like scriptor mostly, it's like technical designer. So you are working on some quest, and so you mostly use this tool alongside with the editor or the game. And I can actually share the screen and show the basics of the tool.
Right? Yeah.
I think it would be like a good time right now. Okay, great. So this is what it looks like. It's not eye appealing really, but
I feel like development apps usually have kind of a more functional interface and less of a pretty one. Yeah.
But since we are on Perforce podcast, I can like mention that we have like P4 connection here. So you can see the workspace, see the server, my name, fortunately not my password. and you can see that the integration is active. So which is the first thing you want to do, right? Because then if you would start working, you would not actually be able to save your files and work with them. It's like probably the similar thing as in editor inside Unreal, you always want to be connected to Perforce, right? So
right.
This is the first thing. And then I have like this project, and everything I show here is basically part of the KCD2 modding tools. So anyone who sees this and looks at it and thinks that it's cool how we created quests, you can actually create your own. It's super hard because the documentation, it's not ideal, let's say, but you can actually do it. And I've seen online that some people actually did parts of these quests, so
yeah.
Or they created new ones, so it's I admire that. And so once you load the project, actually I can go here into the design and you see this hell. And this is
right.
Something
so
we call
a ton of nodes all interconnected with each other.
And this is something we call like electrical switchboard or something like that. So,
uh-huh. Yeah.
And this is basically, if I just show it here, Trosetsko, which is the name of the first map. And if I zoom in, you can actually see the individual quests. And these purple ports are just the data. It's just the data that are being sent like from one quest to another. Part of these things are in Czech. I have everything switched into English, but it's not ideal. So
no,
I'm
that's
sorry
okay.
about that. But you can actually see like the code name for the quest, which is S10, which is side quest 10. Right now, I don't remember the name in English, but I don't think that's important. So if you're actually a scripter and you need to work with this file, you see it's not ideal. And it's probably
right.
not something that we should be proud of, but just so you can see how hard it would be for some quests when they were being created for the first time to actually have it somehow aligned and put it inside place that it would actually work. It was not an easy task.
Yeah, so just to kind of get a sense of this, so each quest in this graph is its own little node, and then it has a bunch of inputs and a bunch of outputs.
Yeah.
And so as examples of what some of those inputs and outputs would be, what kinds of things are those?
Yeah, you can see that there are all different colors. Mm-hmm. So some are just the data, and there are these, I don't know what color it is. It's probably brownish or whatever.
Uh-huh.
This is basically like an execution line. So it's something similar to execution inside Blueprint.
Okay, just saying like this is finished now. You can start the next one.
Yeah, kind of. Like, let's oversimplify. And you have basically these icons that will just like put me inside this quest logic. So if I just go here, I will probably be able to see. I mean, here actually inside the quest, you can actually see some of the real logic, you know. So for example, here you have some OR statements, you know, and if statements, and you have some state boxes and so on. So here you can actually see some real logic. So for example, this quest should happen only when there is this if statement triggered and so on. So
okay, so like you had to have done certain things in previous quests, or you had to have met certain characters or advanced to certain levels, things like that to enable it. And then that those also might change how the quest plays out, depending on, you know, which characters you're closer to or things like that.
Yeah, definitely. This is the case. And some of the logic is still like very complex. So you have graphs inside graphs inside graphs. So you can see these modules that there is another graph inside this.
I see. Yeah, nested graphs. And, okay.
Yeah. And inside here, so you can like orient, you can go back or up always to like see where you actually are. And the hierarchy is also here on the left side. So it's not ideal, but you can orient pretty fair inside it. And yeah, it has some outputs then, and it goes into another quest. And this is basically how the whole logic is being written inside here.
It's interesting to me, too, because anytime I think about these sorts of open world games where there's just so many different factors that could affect things of, you know, which characters are alive or which things have you done or not done, or how do people in different areas feel about your character, all these things that You keep saying, oh, you know, this is a little bit chaotic, or this is a little bit hard to look at because there's so many connections between all of these. But I also think there's really no way around that because there's just so much information that needs to go from one place to another. And so it feels like this constant struggle for people developing games that want to have these very complicated, very open paths for you to explore as the player, so you're not just forced down this one narrative path, but there's a lot of different ways it could go. I feel like designers who are designing tools like yourself, this must be a constant struggle of how do we allow this to expand and do all these complex things while still being manageable to work with.
Yeah, and this is a really good point. And also, it's good to mention that one of the design decisions of this tool was, let's see the complexity, actually, because we could do it in a way that all of these things could be like hidden somehow and encapsulated and so on. But if you actually look at it and you see all the mess, you can actually see the complexity of the game, you know? Like when I open up the switchboard, first time I saw it, my head exploded almost. So,
yeah.
This is something, like, if you look at my mouse here, there are so many lines. And if I just remove one, this could result in some blocker in the game that you would not be able to continue. And this is also insane that you would just, like, delete one line accidentally and it would just go nuts. So you need to have all these processes that are being done after someone changes something inside a game. So whole QA and automation framework for tests and so on, this needs to be complex and like on very good level. Otherwise, the game would just not work.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point you bring up about validation and tests. So, you know, QA is one thing. And I think for a lot of people starting out as an indie developer or a small team, that's kind of their only testing is QA, which is usually themselves playing it, right? They're just kind of trying things and seeing if it works. But with a system this big and this in depth, that's just not feasible to spend 1,000 hours after every change you make to make sure that everything works. So yeah. what is that process like of making those tests and validations automated?
Yeah, I'm just going to oversimplify a lot because it would be just for another podcast just explain everything. But basically what it does, if you're a scripter, then you make some changes inside a quest. The first thing you do before you submit, it will actually run like server-side validations. So on Perforce, we have some triggers that are triggered like before you submit, and it tells you, okay, here you have some issues, go and fix them. And so we have another C# application that can actually work with all these graphs, and it will just like load them, and it will basically go through a lot of things. I don't want to get into the details, but those things need to be checked before that. And those are the first tests that are being done, only like that you have. It can be compared to like a code compilation. If it compiles, then you're good to go. If it doesn't, then, well, you need to fix it.
So just like everything required has been connected and the right type of data goes into the right types of pins, that kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. And this is basically, by the way, all text-based. So all these things that you see here are serialized inside XML files, which is a great advantage because if you had blueprints, it's much harder to work with.
Right. Yeah, you have to have your own special thing to read them and display them and all that. Yeah.
And this is all being done inside Perforce, basically. As I mentioned, there is a trigger. We have like a separate server that's only running these validations for the clients. And then it just like tells the Perforce server, okay, this is fine. You can proceed with the submit. And after that, if everything goes right, then it goes into a build pipeline, right? So then you get a new build, new package, and then, of course, we have QA, so they test some of the things manually. Each quest have a different tester, or maybe some testers have like a few quests, and they need to go through some of the scenarios manually. But as you mentioned, it's super complex, so they cannot do it. And so we have something we call automation framework. And this basically what it does, we have like a build farm that is running. There's one pool only for profiling and testing. And this pool is basically running constantly, like nonstop, every day, every night. And it's going through all the different quests. There are priorities, of course. So some things are more priority. So they are being tested more often. And these tests actually produce some results. If there's something that has broken, then it notifies the scripter or the QA, and they need to go and fix the logic. And these automation tests are, there's a ton of them again, and some of them are maintained by the QA, some of them by the code, some of them by the scripter. So it's like a really huge and complex system. But basically, this is the pipeline. This goes all over again.
And is that automation that you're talking about essentially doing a build of the game and then manipulating the character through it? Or is it doing that kind of statically somehow, like a static analysis type approach?
It's actually running the game, so you have all these tests, and the game is then booted up. It loads into a level, and then it does the logic. Most of the logic is actually being done inside the actual level, not some gym or some fake level that you would only use for one feature, because all of these things are tightly coupled into the environment, you know, so you cannot really have a gym for such a complex quest. We had this approach for KCD1, but it was not working that well. So we actually said, okay, this is probably not a good idea, because when you are moving from the gym into the actual level, a lot of things break again. So you need to run it inside the actual level. And there's a bunch of code inside it that needs to go into implementing all the test commands. So the player is teleported somewhere, and it needs to wait for the streaming, for the rendering, and so on. So it's another complex system that does this.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then when it comes to these quests that are scripted in Scald, that then when those are in the game, I imagine there also needs to be some logic in there about how to preload assets, like the dialogue lines that are coming up or the animations that go with those, so there's not like a weird delay or things getting out of sync.
Yeah. And this really depends on what kind of assets they are, because CryEngine has all different kind of systems for localization, for animation, for brushes, which is basically like a geometry, and so on. I mean, there's tons of them. And each system behaves differently, have different streaming rules, and so on. So this is another thing that's kind of painful to actually want to fix some bug. It might be multiple bugs, because you don't know if the problem is inside the streaming of... I don't know, one thing or the other. Like some rendering programmers, they got a bug, and the bug says, okay, something is blinking in the far on the horizon.
I see.
Like, I don't know what that is, you know. I cannot even see if it's like a house or if it's a tree. And those are two different things, or it might be something else. So this is something we changed a lot for KCD2. All these systems were... not entirely rewritten, but they were modified heavily, all the streaming and so on. This was, for the optimization purposes, this was modified a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And then so when it comes to optimization, you mentioned when we talked before this interview that this tool itself, Scald, also needed to be optimized quite a bit.
Yes.
Because not everyone running it is on a computer that can run a game engine.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, as I mentioned, I have it still shared here, but let's say you only are interested in the dialogues or in the translation or something, so you would just like use this part of the Scald, and you don't need anything else, and you want to run it on notebook or whatever, and you only are doing some sessions inside recording studio, and you have an actor, and he's like recording something, so you only use it for this, for example. And
so you would load your audio files directly into here then?
Yes.
So when you're in the studio, it just goes straight into this tool.
Yeah. They are actually streamed in from Perforce, so it doesn't need to have everything like locally. So for example, if you just want to play some line here, it will be like streamed in when I want to, or when I click this, it's basically, it loads all these inside this table.
I see. So all of those are just on the Perforce server, and then when you click play on one, it'll download that asset so that you can play it. Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense with such a big game, too, where that would be a lot of data that everyone would have to pass around if they needed all of it all the time.
Yeah. So basically, these are like very similar optimizations as in the game itself, you know, because you cannot have all inside memory inside the game, because it contains a lot of assets. They can be audio assets or whatever. So this streaming, as you can see, happens inside this tool as well. So you cannot have everything inside. Or you could, but then it would eat up all the memory and it would load for I don't know how long. So we need to go through these things and optimize as well. Yeah, and so right now you can actually run it on almost everything. You have like some small notebook inside a studio for a director or someone, and he can just like run this application easily.
Yeah, great. So something that you pulled up a second ago was this random encounter. And so first of all, I think it's interesting that this tool is not just for quests, but also for any kind of little scripted interaction that goes back and forth. So one question I have first before we get into this particular interaction is, does this include interactions that don't directly involve the player character, like the conversations that you'll overhear NPCs having with each other?
Yeah. There's, as you can see here, there's something called open world here, and there's a lot of things that you could actually hear inside it. So yes.
Got
that's,
it. Okay.
That's basically the answer. So yeah. Oh, basically this is a script logic and it's part of the script logic. So yes.
I see. So yeah. So it's, I just want to get clear that this is more than just quests. It's kind of anything that involves cause and effect.
Yeah,
maybe.
It's the whole like world.
Little interactions or one thing has to happen after another. Very interesting. So this one that you pulled up, and I mentioned this to you before, is this random interaction that happens. And this happened to me when I was playing the game, where you're walking down this road and there's an old lady there. And this kind of thing happens a lot in the game, right? Where you're traveling somewhere and there's a person on the side of the road, someone wants to talk to you, whatever it is. But then this woman was just being kind of creepy and mysterious. And I was like, I think this is Death. I think this lady is Death. What's going on here? And then we talked for a little while, and then she just walked away into the distance, and I followed her for a while across a field, and then eventually just let her walk away. I was like, that was so weird. So tell me a little bit about that particular interaction, since we can actually see everything that goes on inside of it here.
It's one of many. As you can see, like, we have these random events. And again, sorry for this. We call it Chenglish, which is like Czech and English together. And so this Pocestny, it means like wanderer. So you have all these different wanderers inside.
Got it.
And so you have like a Riddler and prisoner and so on.
Yeah, okay. And I'm looking at the names. I'm like, yeah, I've seen a lot of these people. I know what's going on here.
Yeah, so some of these you might know, and one of them is the Death, as you mentioned. So, which is the lady that you might actually come across, and you have something we call this like dialogue visualizer. So you can actually see here. I can even on the left see the lines here. They are in English. So, Jindřich, which is Henry in English, tries saying, "What are you doing here?" And it goes on and on. And Pocestný smrt, which means like wanderer death. She's answering, "I'm resting," and so on. And you have all these decisions. If I go here, I can like scroll down, and it will actually like pop up here where inside the tree it is.
So we can see the different decisions you make of how to respond goes off into a different branch, and that might end the conversation or have other choices.
Exactly. This is basically the decision tree, and this one's pretty straightforward, but you can see some trees that are so branched that you cannot even visualize properly.
Right.
But this one's really straightforward, and it just like says a few lines, and this is only like the dialogue logic. But if I go inside the concept graph here, it will just take a moment. So this is actually the logic that the scripter writes.
I see. So the kind of the script logic and the dialogue logic are separate from each other.
Yeah, well, the dialogue logic is basically here, but it's triggered from the code. So it's only like here, but like some other part of it is inside the actual game. So when you press E, some magic happens, and then this dialogue plays.
Right.
But you can see part of the logic inside the script. So basically, when you spawn this event, there's some things that happen. There's some timer and some uninteresting stuff that's happening. But then there's some like check, so you can see that this is actually City Wanderer. If it's not City Wanderer, then you can proceed, and it has to be in night. And so if these both are through, then something can happen.
Yeah. And so I see that there's a trigger to enter this particular one that says death is enabled. I'm assuming then that something must happen in the game that allows this one to end up in the random encounters that can happen.
Yeah, exactly. But if I go, like, I have only this small node open. So if I go up, so you can actually see this huge tree again. And it's just a mess. So it's these are all the events, and all these data is coming from somewhere. I don't know where they're coming from right now. I would just like need to follow the line.
Right.
And eventually, at the end of the day, I could tell you what it does. But that's like, if something like this, you need to know the very details of it. You just go to the scriptor that actually
and
did
you can
it
just
because,
follow this all the way back through the logic to figure out what caused that.
Exactly. So this is basically it. This is how it's scripted. And if I go, I can show one more cool thing. I can go into the decision tree and let's say I'm a designer and I want to see how the death is actually talking. I can actually select, for example, this decision, and I can go into IDA here, which is a tool that is used for like custom animations, facial animations, and you can also see like different audio files, and I can actually play it. And this is something you actually as a player hear inside the game.
Right.
This is the actual English dialogue. And this is not really very... There are not many modifications that you would see, like some special animations, but you can see that where the Henry should look, that he's looking at the death. So he's not like just like randomly wandering with his eyes around.
Right.
Yeah, this is another tool that you can actually use inside Sculpt. And this is tightly connected to the game. Unfortunately, I don't have the game ready right now, but you could actually change something here and then like in real time, just like reload this part of the dialogue and actually see the change.
So in this tool, the lip sync, I'm imagining, is handled automatically through some other system, but that this is where you would do things like what their facial expression should be here, or whether they should be like pointing at something or gesturing in a certain direction, things like that you can control in here?
Yes, this is exactly right. These are all like tiny little modifications that the NPCs actually don't look robotic, that they just don't stare. They're staring at each other, but they are just like doing these things that I'm doing, hopefully, inside of this podcast, that I'm just trying to like a little bit wander around with my hands or, you know,
right.
just sliding from side to side and so on. So this is part of it. And we have animation department. Part of this animation department, we have like these gesture experts, and they are... basically manually trying to make some of these dialogue nicer. If it's a dialogue inside the main quest, it's obviously basically seen by every player, so we try to take time and make it as eye appealing as possible.
Yeah, so that you have this kind of library of different gestures and different, obviously, facial expressions and moods and things that then the actual level designers can come in here, or not level designers, but the, I guess, sort of dialogue directors or something can actually tweak those right in this tool without having to go get custom animations for every single piece of dialogue.
Yeah, exactly right.
Nice. So I want to hit you with a few kind of rapid fire questions that came up for me while playing the game. And the reason why I mentioned that my wife commented on this is because I was playing this on the PlayStation, actually, instead of on my PC. So, you know, just be there in the living room. And it was interesting hearing from her what things she noticed about the game, just from the lines of dialogue that she would hear often. And one that, like, from the other room, she came in, she's like, wait, what? Was when Henry yelled out, I feel quite hungry, when he was fighting. And that would happen fairly often because I had a perk where yelling at my enemies would shake their resolve or whatever and maybe make them give up. So I would use that taunt, or not taunt, but the yell button. And often he would say, I feel quite hungry. Tell me, how did that end up in the game? There are occasional things like this that were just so silly, it felt like someone had to know this was a joke when they put it in.
Yeah. So when the first game released, basically became like a meme because it was just part of the dialogue when you were actually hungry inside the game. So when
I see,
you know, so when you haven't eaten for a while, then there were a few lines, and one of those lines was, I feel quite hungry. And it became like an internet meme. I don't know how, but that's just how things happen usually. And then when the second game was in development, of course people knew about it, that people were making fun of it, so they say, okay, we have like these battle cries inside the game, so when you're fighting, wouldn't it be fun if he would just say, I feel quite hungry, when he's like smashing you with a hammer or something like that. So yeah, and we had like all these different lines when you were fighting, and one of them was this one. And yeah, so that's why it's kind of weird for people that haven't heard about this, because if you're just like running around and you just start fighting with someone, you're just like expecting to say some swear words, you know, or just like some, I don't know, completely different thing than I feel quite hungry. And by the way, I think that we can actually find it here inside if I just write the line.
I see, so you can just search. I feel quite hungry.
And yeah, so it can actually find a few things, and you can see it's here in the battle cry. So for example, if I go into the dialogue again, just give it a second. Yeah, so here you can see it's inside this decision, and it basically like has all these different possible things that inside the battle cry you can say.
Got
it's
it.
Basically branched by Hrachi Bohuta, it means like it's player Father Godwin. So Father Godwin is, so there are separate things for him, and then there are separate things for Henry, because Father Godwin obviously cannot say this cool line.
Right.
And I think it should be still like a bark that you do when you're actually hungry. So here you can see it as well.
Got it.
So yeah, we, as you can see, we still have it in the game.
Wow. Yeah. So that one's a holdover from a meme from the first one. So another one that I thought was funny was the word wares is said a lot. And this was another one that I didn't notice at first until I'd been playing a while. And with every merchant that Henry would go to, very often he'd see like, show me your wares. And that would be this kind of, it became a meme in our house, actually. It was anytime we're going to go shopping or something, was like, I'm going to go look at some wares.
Okay.
And so for those sorts of things about the words and the dialogues that come up, were there any of these that happened in the studio that like the developers kind of latched onto or started to say in their lives?
I'm not sure if it's for the dialogues. Well, actually it is. There's inside the deal, because we are Czech, so a lot of things are like Czech oriented, because it doesn't hurt the people like from America or somewhere else, they just don't understand the, you know, the actual meaning of the line.
Right.
But there are some like Czech memes that only Czech people get, and it's maybe better if not everyone on the earth actually gets the reference, because it might not be the most polite one. But there were definitely some things. There's one Czech guy who's actually repairing a tractor. And it's like a meme video for 10 minutes. He's just swearing. And some of these dialogues are actually in the DLC.
I see.
So that's one I can think of. But these are not only the dialogues. I mean, our sound designers are trying to be funny as well. So there are some like lines. If you're going through the Gutenberg city at night, you can actually hear some homeless person shouting something, and you cannot understand it because it's in Czech, but that's another Czech meme.
I see.
That's like very, very popular here. And yeah, so, but there are also some Easter eggs that hasn't been found yet. And
really?
Yeah, they are just so obscure. I remember one of my fellow programmer colleague, he did that. I don't know if I should actually speak about it, because it hasn't
You don't
been
have
found,
to give it away. So. Yeah, you don't have to give it away. Yeah. But just that's good to know for all of you out there that there are still undiscovered things in KCD2.
Yeah, so I believe it's connected to some specific chest inside a game, a specific item, maybe, I don't know, something like that.
All right.
So maybe someone will find it in the future.
Nice. Yeah, that's so interesting. So you also then get a certain amount of data back so you can kind of tell what's been explored in the game?
Yeah, I mean, like so many people play it, and then when someone finds something really cool, they just tend to do a YouTube video about it, or they just put it on Reddit or something like that. And our community managers, they just like scan everything, I feel like.
I see, so, trying to keep track of what people have found and what's happening.
So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I just don't have enough information, but I think that if it would be found, I would know about it. So
okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
But there were even like some bigger features in the game, for example, cats. This was a feature that was cut from the beginning, and they said, okay, we don't have time for another pet or another animal inside the game.
Ah.
But there were so many cat lovers inside our studio that they just like did it and just asked no one, basically. And then they just came and said, okay, it's in the game. And so someone said, okay, if it's ready, then let's put it inside. And that's it was funny. Like effort of a lot of people. It was maybe, I don't know, like 5 or 6 people working on this feature after the hours. They just went home for a weekend, and after the weekend, the colleague showed me, okay, I have this goal for this cat that she like it can play animations and jump and so on. I was like, okay, cool.
Nice. That's great. One other kind of random question that I had is I noticed that a lot of this game is very historically accurate. It feels like it's actually going for that. There's a lot of the codex things that will give you more context about historically what this actually was or who this character is based on, which I thought was really interesting.
We have a few people, like historians, inside our design team, or they are just advisors only for these kind of things. And they go like very into a very detail. And I was surprised actually sometimes what details are they like going to. There were some kind of food that they need to be redone or just completely scratched from the game because someone modeled something and they found out that it was not accessible back then.
Ah, wow.
And there was some kind of a tree that they somehow found out that it couldn't grow back then inside Central Europe and so
wow.
on. So a lot of detailed research went into this. And so I was surprised into the detail and effort they put inside of studying these things. So
yeah.
It's interesting for me, but I don't know much about history, which is a shame and probably a disgrace for me as a developer working on this kind of game. But I'm always super curious when they come up with these details, and we talk about it sometimes in pub over a beer.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's very cool. I also spent a lot of time while playing the game looking things up on Wikipedia to be like, wait, what actually was the deal with King Wenceslas? Like, what happened at that time? What was going on here? So I definitely learned some things from this game as well, in addition to enjoying it.
That's cool.
So as we're wrapping up, I want to end with a question. So if you have any advice for someone who's maybe newer in the game industry or newly getting into a job making more internal tools like Scald that you're working on, is there any particular advice that you would give to them?
Yeah, it might be one of them. To be curious is, I think, the most important thing, because such a project is so complex. And if you're curious and if you just like go to your colleague to show you something, you can just like learn so much from just talking to other people. You don't actually need to develop something, but you just like talking to some designer or environment artist or whoever. It's like you just have the big picture of the whole project, and it can like help you in your profession, whatever it is. I just wouldn't be afraid to ask to start. And now everyone has AI, but to be asking your colleagues about some specific stuff that's like a tribal knowledge inside your studio, that's also something that I think a good developer should have, not be afraid to ask for help.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the idea of connecting with the other people that you have access to within your community, within your group of game developers, or if you're part of a larger community, because, you know, with AI, we have a lot of access to information, but it's kind of this, I think of it as like the average information of everybody. But what you get from your colleagues is the stuff that's not average, the stuff that's surprising or unique or maybe isn't a standard but could be useful for you. And so getting that kind of information, I just find to be so valuable, being able to have those conversations with people who have opinions or different experiences.
Definitely. I think that you have like this, the AI for these generic things, but according to game design that's just specific for your game, you cannot get that out of AI just yet. I don't know, in a few years, but
yeah.
Right now, we are still not being removed.
So yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, and I think just the amount of care, but also the creativity and surprise that happens in the game, like these memes and random references and things like that. I love having that human touch in the game, too. So thank you so much for joining me today and for sharing all of this. This is really interesting. And people who are really interested in how this tool works can download these as part of the modding tools?
Yes, exactly. They are part of the modding tools on Steam. So if you want to just like wander around, see the individual lines that are in the game, or you want to tweak something, you can definitely do that. And if you're brave enough, I think you can just to your own quest, but be prepared that it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I think like only a few people have actually done it. If you go through the individual modes of our game, you can find some, but it's definitely not an easy task. And I'm not sure even if I would be able to do it. If someone would tell me just like, do this, I probably would, but it would take me a lot of time because you basically need a knowledge of all the different departments inside a studio. You need to be partially programmer, partially scripter, partially designer, and so on. So you need to have all these different things that you need to combine. And then maybe if you're lucky enough, you can actually create your own quest.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see what people come up with. If anyone's made a quest, let me know. I'd love to check it out. So thank you so much, Peter, for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you very much as well for the talk. It was a very pleasant time. So thanks.
If you enjoy this kind of in-depth conversation with leaders in the media, gaming, and visualization world, be sure to subscribe so that you get new episodes as soon as they come out. Subscribing and giving a review or rating is the only way that we know you enjoy this content so that we can keep making more of it. Reach out to me via email or LinkedIn with feedback, guest suggestions, or to connect if you'd like to be a guest yourself. I'm always looking for great stories, and I love learning about the many ways that game and real-time technologies are being used today. Links for that are in the episode description. Be sure to check out perforce.com for information about our full P4 platform based on the industry standard Perforce P4 version control. Special thanks to our production team, Ella Reiswig, Emily Matlack, Kaylee Torres, Luisa Pujala, and Chris Perez. I'm Jace Lindgren, and I will see you next time on In Development.